Okay, I just wanted to conclude the section beginning in verse 13 and go down through verse 21, which is Jesus feeding 5,000 men besides women and children with just 5 loaves and 2 fishes. With regard to that, we noted that Jesus had the ability to set his own troubles aside, that this was very shortly after the death of John the Baptist. He had sought solitude to mourn John's passing and to pray to God. Then he, immediately upon seeing the multitude that had gathered, had compassion upon them. He was concerned about their well-being, and as a result of that, because they did not have food, he fed them with just those few things, indicating again not only his compassion, his interest in others, but also his ability, because he was God. He had the ability to create out of nothing. Scarcity of resources was not something that was a challenge to him. And so he was able to feed those 5,000 individuals together with the women and children. And that makes me wonder if it was double that or how many there actually were there. But after they had eaten, we're told in verse 20 of the text, they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of the fragments that remained. Now, we're going to be talking when we get into the 15th chapter about the feeding of the 4,000. So this is another event that happened fairly soon after. But the one thing that we did not have time to mention is the fact that this particular passage, and that of the feeding of the 4,000, is actually a passage that individuals turn to in order to justify what we'll refer to as the social gospel. That is, that one of the primary purposes of the church is to effect social change, to accomplish a physical good in the world. And there are many people who believe that's the primary focus, or should be the primary focus of the church. In fact, you have as an example the Salvation Army, which was something that began in the 19th century, specifically when this view became popular in the United States. And they thought that the best thing that we can do as a church, because the Salvation Army is a church, is to emphasize the helping and care of those who are physically needy. And they would use a passage such as this as a justification for that, because after all, Jesus fed the 5,000. So I wanted to note a couple of things. First of all, that's not justification for the church going beyond the bounds and purposes for which God has revealed he built the church or established the church. He's made very clear what the limitations are. 1 Timothy 5 is a good place to go to, where you'll remember that the church is not to be burdened with those who are not widows indeed. It's only those who are widows indeed, that is, of that congregation who truly are widows, they do not have family, that they are to care for them. And that indicates that with regard to the benevolent aspect of this, that there is a severe limitation that God places upon the obligations of the local church. He intends for individual Christians to be benevolent in their activities, but he limits, curtails pretty significantly what the church is to do. The church is a spiritual institution with a spiritual mission to edify and to evangelize, and that's where the emphasis should be for the church. But that is even something that was indicated in Jesus' teaching in John chapter 6. I'd like you to turn to John chapter 6 very quickly. And note that after he fed them, in this particular occasion, the entire chapter of John 6 deals with the way in which the individuals who were filled misconstrued his actions. And verses 26 and 27 are especially appropriate here, where Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled." So the reason why so many were following him is because what he was willing to give them physically, the blessings that they would receive from him physically, not because they were convinced by the miracles that he was the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And his answer to them there in verse 27 is not to labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life. So this puts it in the proper perspective. Our outlook, our interest with it with regard to the Christ is not to get rich. It's not to be filled physically, but rather the purpose is to be filled spiritually. And so there you find one of the primary problems in what we might refer to as the Americanized Christianity that we see around us today, and that is that gospel of health and wealth, the idea that if I give myself to Christ, that as a result of that, I'm going to benefit in some physical way. It didn't happen in the first century. I mean, they had the things that were needful, as Matthew chapter 6 tells us, but as far as their lot in life, they were often persecuted, often reviled as a result of it. It was not an easy thing. And to go into it with the idea, I'm going to get something like that out of it, is the wrong way of looking at it. And so just kind of indicate that while Jesus was moved with compassion, the signs that he performed, this sign in particular, is to bring them to a spiritual mindset, not merely to fill their stomachs. And if they had the idea that the reason they were going to follow Jesus is because he's going to fill their stomachs, they got it wrong. And when he indicated the right view of this, we were told that many went away and followed him no longer. It was a hard saying for them, and they weren't willing to accept it. And so he lost a lot of these disciples because of that spiritual bent that he wanted them to recognize and understand. Okay, so that's basically all I wanted to add to the feeding of the 5,000. Anybody have any questions or comments that they want to make about that section other than what we've talked about? Yes?
If you still got John 6, we was reading there, as a side note, that's the verses right there, and it has nothing to do with there it says, those in the denominations, once saved, always saved, they've been sealed, you know. And they use that the wrong way. But in 27, which John 6, and when you didn't finish that, but anyway, which endures everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him. Set his seal. That explains what that seal means.
Okay.
And then the next verse of those denominations, that, well, there's no work that we do. But 28 says, they said to him, what shall we do that we may work the works of God? And Jesus answered, this is the work of God, that you believe in him who he sent. And so I would point out, well, belief is a work.
Yeah.
You have to do. You know, and so I just thought throw that out along the leaves right there.
Okay.
Good deal. I never can find them, the verses where I need them.
Well, that's one of the good things about this survey is we're coming across and becoming a little bit more familiar with verses that we know but maybe can't find. Okay, someone read for me, if you will, verses 22 through 33 of Matthew 14. Someone like to volunteer to do that? Matthew 14, 22 through 33.
Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it is a ghost. And they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So he said, come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him, and said to him, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God.
One of the things to just note, because it I think is an interesting point, in verse 31, he calls them those of little faith. Go over to chapter 15 very quickly and just note. No, wait a second. Matthew. Trying to find where it is. Oh yeah, Matthew 15 and verse 21. So after the events that we're talking about today, Jesus went north of Galilee into the region of Tyre and Sidon, which is in Phoenicia. So he's basically among the Gentiles here. And a woman of Canaan comes to him. And after their discussion, she wanted him to heal her daughter. He basically insulted her, said, "You're a dog," using that phrase, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But she was very humble and desired, as she worshipped him, to have her daughter healed. And I want you to notice in verse 28, Jesus answered and said to her, "A woman, great is your faith." Now, I think it's kind of an interesting thing, because faith is always the key. And even though the Jews, even though his disciples, with all of their teaching, that they had this great advantage, there were times when their faith failed them. I don't want to be too harsh on them, because I think I would probably be in the same boat as they were in some of these things. A lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding, trials and temptations besetting them. But every once in a while, in all of these discussions that we're having of the characters of these, you come across an individual where Jesus takes the time to say, "That's great faith. That's a tremendous faith." An individual who says, "You don't have to come to my house. All you have to do is say the word and my servant will be healed." It's great faith. And this particular occasion, it's great faith that she said, "Regardless of what you think of the Gentiles, I worship you as the Son of David, and would you heal my daughter?" And that was great faith on that particular occasion. So it's kind of an interesting thing. Faith is always rewarded by the Lord. But on this particular occasion, we find some limitations with regard to the faith of the disciples. A couple of things to note in the context of Matthew 14, 22 and following. First of all, you'll notice that right after he fed the 5,000, immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him the other way and sent the multitudes away. So it was immediate action. You might say, well, why were they in such a hurry? Or why was he in such a hurry? Well, if you look at the parallel reading in John 6, right after he fed the 5,000, in verse 15, he said that Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king. And as a result of that, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. So again, he sought solitude, but on this particular occasion, they were so enamored of him because of the fact that he fed them, that they were willing to, by force, take him to make him the king. It's an amazing thing how the mob mentality, how that individuals will basically disregard the wishes of the individual just for the purpose of fulfilling their own desires and wishes. So Jesus understood what was going on, and as a result of that, he and his disciples basically ran away. They fled quickly to avoid that kind of thing happening. So on this particular occasion, Jesus had separated himself from his disciples. He went to a mountain by himself to pray, and he was there for a while. The disciples had gotten on the boat, and now the boat was in the middle of the sea. Now, the Sea of Galilee, again, is a lake, so it's not something to where you might not think, well, how could he see them or how far away they were? You can see one shore from the other. And Jesus then walks on the water to them. And I want you to consider first the superstitious response of the disciples in verse 26. We're told when they saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. So we're not the only ones that have a lot of people among us who believe in ghosts. Now, there's no indication, again, from this particular phrase that there's any legitimacy to that. There are indications when God has divinely sent individuals back. You remember on the Mount of Transfiguration that Elijah and Moses were brought back to appear before the disciples. But the idea of disembodied spirits walking the earth, it's as much a superstition today as it was then. I don't think we ought to speak to or think too harshly of the disciples, because again, this might be a common superstition, and after all, you don't see men walking on water. And so there was that that response that they made. But what is interesting, I think, is the identification of Jesus to his disciples. He said in verse 27, "Be of good cheer, it is I. Do not be afraid." Now, the "it is I" is a translation of a Greek term, Greek phrase, ego, E-I-M-I, however you pronounce that. And that is the exact wording that the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, of the Old Testament Scriptures, It's the exact wording that the Septuagint uses to translate God's identification of himself to Israel. Who am I? I am the I am. The I am. So there's a possibility that, this phrase was being used by Jesus to identify himself in that very same way. It would be a very grand self-identification that Jesus refers to himself as the I am. That's the same exact phrase that he's used in the Hebrew Scriptures. So, don't know that that is the case, but that is certainly a possibility. Be of good cheer, the I am, or I am the I am, that kind of an idea there. So he would identify himself not only as their teacher, as their master, but also as God the Son in regard to that. It is a sign of deity, and that very well may be a part of that self-identification. We note in verses 32 and 33 that when he got into the boat, the wind ceased, and they were in the boat, came and worshipped him, saying, "You are the Son of God." So that may be an acknowledgement of his identification of himself was actually so. He is the I am. He is the Son of God. So that is kind of an interesting thing. So when we talk about the miracle on this particular occasion, it is one that is amply demonstrated in other occasions. Jesus' ability to still the storm, to control the elements, to walk on water is all an indication of just how great and mighty he is. It is an indication, again, of his power over the created universe. And so he had this ability. Now, the second aspect of this is Peter. And so Peter, he walks on the water toward him. The interesting thing is that none of the other disciples asked to go to him. We always look at Peter, and he was sort of kind of an impetuous individual. But we talk a lot about Peter's failures. And almost invariably, his failures were because of his successes. I mean, you take as an example on the night that Jesus was betrayed and the disciples scattered, the only individual who first said, "I will never forsake you," then followed at a distance. He was the only one. And we talk about how he failed Jesus in that when push came to shove, he denied him three times. But he was the only one who was present. None of the others were in a position to falter in that regard. His affirmation in Matthew chapter 16, which we'll talk about in a week or two, where they said, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Blessed are you, Simon Barjona," that's Peter, "because flesh and blood is not revealed to you, but my Father in heaven." So he was a bold individual, very much a bold individual. On this particular occasion, bold enough to ask in verse 28, "If it's you, command me to come to you on the water." So you're walking on the water. Peter says, if it's you, Lord, then let me come to you." That would be an indication to him that it was truly his master, that he was able to walk on water. And it happened. Now, the weird thing about this is that as he was walking on the water to go to Jesus, verse 29, he saw that the wind was boisterous and was afraid and beginning to sink. He cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." Now, that's a little bit incongruous to us, the idea that, okay, wow, I'm walking on water, Jesus is here, in effect, whatever he wants me to do, I can do. But then, at the same time, he sees the storm, and it's boisterous, and the waves and such, and that's what causes him to lose heart and to doubt. And we think about that, and again, maybe we judge him a bit harshly as a result of it. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is because our faith is also tempted and tested quite often. And I want you to think about the fact that when our faith is tested, it doesn't necessarily mean that we start doubting that God exists. We believe that God exists. We believe that Jesus Christ is his Son. We have faith in that, and our faith is not shaken in those things. But then difficulties in our life come about, and what we begin to doubt is either their willingness or their ability to help us. And so even though we have that great faith, we begin to falter faith in the acknowledgement and recognition that God exists and that Jesus is his Son. We still falter, and doubts enter into our minds, not because of we doubt that, but doubt that application of that to our own lives. What we're doubting, in effect, is the promises of God, that he is willing to and that he is able to help us. And so I think, again, though we look at this and we may be a little bit harsh in our judging of Peter, why in the world would Peter begin to sink after he's already walking on the water? But we too, we sometimes have a difficult trial or testing of our faith that leads us to falter somewhat as well, to have doubts and fears in our own minds. But the lesson is that if Peter had kept his focus on Christ and ignored everything else, he would have been able to come to Jesus. And of course, when he cried out, "Oh, Lord, save me," in verse 31, immediately Jesus stretched out his hand, caught him, and then said, "Your faith is small. Your faith was not sufficient." If we keep our focus on Christ and trust in Him, then it doesn't matter what's swirling about. It doesn't matter all the storms of life, all of those kinds of things. If our focus is on Christ, our faith can remain strong. But if we become distracted, and that's what we're looking at rather than focusing on Him, that's when we falter as well. I think there's a wonderful object lesson for us in this particular passage, keeping our focus on Christ. I started preaching now. Anybody have any comments, questions up to this point?
Where it says in verse 31, it says, "Oh, you little faith." But if you look at verse 30, it had still that partial faith. Because normally when you step in the water, you sink immediately. But it says he was afraid and was beginning to sink. So he didn't immediately sink. So I don't know if that means he had partial faith.
I think that's more an indication that Jesus was in control. And as Jesus perceived his doubts, that Jesus allowed that to happen and to teach him that lesson. Yeah. So
that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that would be the more of the focus we should put on it. I want to read to you one passage from Hebrews 12, the first two verses, which kind of teaches that lesson for us to keep our focus on Christ. You'll remember the 11th chapter has reference to all those champions of faith in the Old Testament who, despite their trials and tribulations, remain faithful to God, looking forward to what they would not witness or receive apart from us. And so his conclusion in chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 says, "Therefore we also, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God." We see there in the sacrifice, he accomplished our redemption. In his reigning, he accomplished our eternal standing. And so if we keep our focus on him, looking to Jesus, who began our faith, he's the originator of it, he is the realization of it, then we will not falter. We will be able to endure. Beautiful passage, Hebrews chapter 12. All right, that gets us through that section. If there are no questions or comments about it. The last three verses is a reference to some more healing that went on. We're told when they crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret, or Gennesaret. And when the men of that place recognized him, they sent out into all that surrounding region and brought to him all who were sick. And they begged him that they might only touch the hem of his garment. As many as touched it were made perfectly well. And so the region, you may remember from our study 2 weeks ago, if you look at the Sea of Galilee, on the western shore, there is a bulge in the sea. It's the widest part of the sea, and just north of that bulge is that region of Gennesaret. So that's where he was at that particular time. And they recognized his abilities, and they healed. They called upon the sick, and he healed them. And the healing, just to note this, the healing was not partial healing. As many as touched his garments were made whole. They were made perfectly well. That's the nature of a miracle. So what you see practiced and claimed today is not a 22nd cousin of what actually occurred in the first century. So Jesus' compassion is something that I think is perhaps the primary emphasis of this particular chapter with regard to the mourning of the death of his cousin, and then the feeding of the 5,000, and then here on this occasion, so many people healed because of his abilities. And so compassion is a big part of it when we look at his miracles. Okay, questions, comments before we get into chapter 15? Covered that pretty quickly,
Same thing in the New Testament with Paul, you know, with his handkerchiefs, even get his handkerchiefs and it would even be healed.
Yeah. Yeah, the way in which that happens, again, it's not, and again, you'll have these fake healers in the religious world today that will say, you know, send me $50 and I'll give you this blessed hanky, or we'll give you holy water in this little vial, you know, and what it's supposed to be is supposed to be blessed by the healer and such, and it has these magical properties. There is absolutely nothing magical about the hem of Jesus' garment. It had nothing to do with the hem itself. It had to do with the fact that this was something that Jesus had determined to do, and because he determined to do it, by his power, these individuals were healed. The talismans that are so prevalent in the religious world today, I mean, you take as an example Indiana Jones, the first Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you got the Ark of the Covenant, and it had these magical powers. That was the whole concept, you know, and of course they opened it up and their face melted. And then in another one of the stories, one of the Indiana Jones, it was the chalice, the Holy Grail, the cup that Jesus supposedly used. And the idea was that if you drink from this cup, you'll have eternal life because of the cup. You got the Catholics with regard to their view of the talismans and the fact that if I have this particular medallion or this particular figurine or whatever, and I bury it in the backyard, I'm going to sell my home real quickly. I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff that goes on with regard to it. And that's just the tendency. I've always wondered why it was that the Ark, for example, the Noah's Ark, has never been found, or why we don't have the relic of the cross upon which Jesus was hung. But it's an obvious thing. In fact, the Catholic Church, with regard to the cross, there have been so many splinters of the cross that have been sold over the centuries that it is enough to fell a forest. You know, it's snake oil is what it is. And people have that tendency to those things. And so we need to recognize that as for what it is.
It was like they did with the brazen serpent. When they put it away, and when they found it, they started worshiping it.
Yeah.
Same thing with the ark.
Well, all those tendencies are present in men, and God understands that. And something we need to be careful about, which is why that concept of idolatry was so prevalent in the religious world and remains there to this day, and why idolatry is such a horrific thing. But that's men's tendencies.
As to the superstition of the disciples here, one thing that I'm curious about is we see multiple instances in the Gospels when there were demons involved. The legion, when it was cast into the pigs and the pigs drowned themselves. Or I think there's one encounter when someone's trying to drive out demons, like, we know this, we know them, but who are you? I almost wonder if their superstition was more justly founded than ours because they had those demon encounters back then versus today, where you see demons and, oh, it's witchcraft and fiction and whatnot. I wonder if there's any indication as to if demon possession was more than just watching exorcists back then. If people could really tell and say, oh, look, there's someone that's truly demon possessed, or if it's just, again, superstition that would then give some credence to, oh, look, there's a ghost.
Yeah. It's difficult, if not impossible, for us to tell by the narrative, I think. When you look at it, it's always matter of fact if it is a demon or if it's not. You know, it's something certainly that Jesus could ascertain and know, but there's nothing really said about as to why it was an obvious thing or if it was obvious to others as well. That I'm aware of. I know a number of individuals to where, you know, there was a natural strength, for example, on one occasion, to where they tried to exorcise a demon that existed. So supernatural strength may have been something that was evident. There were demons that spoke out and identified themselves. So there was that. But an individual who was crazy might say that as well. So I don't know. All of the demonstrations of the demon possession had to do with illness or crazy behavior. it seems like. So I don't know that there was anything that was readily identifiable about any of it, other than Jesus knowing and the apostles knowing about those things. Now, having said that, the demons did exist, certainly, and there was the supernatural that they were witnessing, and it was in evidence. When we're talking about spirits or ghosts, in other words, those who have departed coming back, that's always an indication of divine demonstration of power in one way or the other. In other words, God makes that decision. In Luke 16, with regard to the rich man and Lazarus, they died. They went to the Hadean world. There's this great gulf fixed. He asks, send Lazarus back. Abraham said, no. They've got the prophets and Moses. They don't need to one come back from the dead. So it's something that's granted by God. The one thing that I can think of, besides Elijah and Moses and the transfiguration, that becomes evident is the bodies that were raised from the dead at Christ's crucifixion and walking in the city. And that was a witness. But again, that was something that was a sign of Christ's crucifixion, that it was from God, that he was from God. So, interesting thing. But again, so if we say superstition, certainly, again, for us to think, well, they're ridiculous, they ought to have known better, and then we're being a little bit harsh in our judgment of them. We should recognize that a very peculiar situation they saw themselves in, and it was an obvious conclusion they might make.